top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
My grandmother was right. The boogeyman was real.
It's over.
We can't hurt anyone ever again.
No one told you.
Told me what?
Somebody in there?
Michael Myers is alive.
Stop! You had a knife in your stomach.
You and Allison should not have to keep running. Evil dies tonight.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 365 of the Really Awful Movies podcast. A few ruminations on the quite lousy, I think really bargain basement, latter two Halloween installments. Not burying the lead here, but it's something that's been nagging at me for a few days, which is weird. I mean, I did see Halloween Kills, I think, several weeks back, and found myself thoroughly, thoroughly disappointed. And it dawned on me that not only is John Carpenter's 1978 film singular and iconic, but I think every subsequent sequel, and I mean every single one, does it a disservice. Even ones that have, in retrospect and in hindsight, increased in their estimation amongst the public, like Season of the Witch. And I think Halloween 2, to a certain extent, is a kind of a capable, if somewhat pedestrian, sequel, but it's actually kind of well done, and you can tell that it has Deborah Hill and John Carpenter's input, even if, Carpenter infamously noted at the time, he refused to direct a sequel, thinking that he had accomplished all he needed to accomplish. It's a proposition with which I wholly agree. I mean, let's be honest, right? What's frustrating about 2018 and 2021 and the two Halloween movies is that each has what the other lacks. I mean, they're both lacking considerably, and there's only a smattering of, I think, usable material from each, but I think they could have made one decent film, and then they could have, I guess, tied the bow around it for the Halloween Ends. Although I'm not sure this is something that I would like to see happen, because it messes around with the mystique of the original one again. And there's a whole different set of ways that both films do that. I think what made the original so iconic and so unforgettable is just how self-contained and quiet it is. And I'm thinking, just when you have Halloween Kills and its mob scene, a rehash and the retread of Halloween 4 with a bunch of townsfolk rallying together to dispense with the boogeyman, it was done better in 4. And there was no need to rehash that, but it doesn't matter. The whole point of it is that there's someone lurking in the shadows, going about their business, and there's not some big to-do about it. There's no one knows what is going on. It's not like they're seeking input from some FBI profile or to try and get to the bottom of it. What makes it so great and so taut and so tight is you just have a minimal number of characters and just atmosphere to spare, just gobs and gobs and gobs of atmosphere. I think the laundry scene with Michael Myers appearing to Laurie Strode, who's looking out the window and just in a sort of static stance, is one of the most epic and unbelievable scenes in the entire horror pantheon. And a small, self-contained film is something that the 2018's Halloween completely eschewed, when you just had random people seemingly just murdered in vignette fashion, almost a la Friday the 13th, and does a disservice to Halloween to draw comparisons to the Jason Voorhees character, because really what draws people to Halloween and what draws people to the first movie is the gobs of atmosphere. It has nothing to do with the brutal kills. And updating a film with brutal kills is neither here nor there. As I noted, a reviewer say this week, The Prowler had awesome kills. Tom Savini's just iconic special effects. But it's, let's be honest, it's a dud crap movie. It's silly, it's stupid, it's a lot of fun, but it's nothing that you would put on your Mount Rushmore of horror. So yes, great. Fabulous kills, rich, violent, bloody kills, and much is made of the eye gouging. But if you're a seasoned dyed-in-the-wool horror fan like Jeff and I, you'll have seen Lucio Fulci do that much better at least three or four times across his career, maybe even more, and do it in a way that's so much more visceral, so much more impactful than the typical squashing of a gourd or a vegetable that the David Gordon Green brings to us. We've seen it before, been done better, and we bought the t-shirt. When it comes to Halloween 2018, I mean, that was wholly lacking in atmosphere, which is really weird, but I think the blame can be laid at the feet of David Gordon Green. Pineapple Express, kind of a fun movie, but the guy's pedigree does not lend itself to directing horror movies, nor is he much of a writer, as the exposition vomit of Halloween Kills really shows us. It's just garbage. But Halloween 2018 lacked atmosphere and dispensed with a character's mobile phone in the most hackneyed and embarrassingly pathetic way possible when it went into the punch bowl. Part of me died when I saw that. It was just so ham-fisted and so tedious and so weak. And not to mention, I mean, Jeff and I are podcasters ourselves, and then you have this podcasting duo investigating this, what should be said should be rather forgettable little story of a guy who knifed a few people in 1978. It's not this set of kills that has hooked the imagination of the American public for decades, like the Ted Bundy murders or the cannibal in Milwaukee there, the Jeffrey Dahmer. It's not something that has continued resonance. And if it did, it would be something you would have to really build up and emphasize in a way to bring back, make a twist on the 1978 film. They don't really do that. Besides, another dumb moment, and this was even highlighted in the trailer, was when you have the podcasters go into this asylum and they're freely allowed to saunter in and goad the notorious killer with the tools of his trade, i.e. mask. Like, on what planet would that be allowed to happen anywhere? It'd be one thing if it was a dispassionate, maybe academic or clinician who would be allowed to visit him and ask him a bunch of questions to further a cause of research, but just to have two bozos with a Zoom microphone go in there and for podcast fodder and wave a mask around at him and have this asinine chessboard set up like it's like it's Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal or something, and a bunch of ooga booga ooga booga like mask shaking, and that is just such a silly, pointless scene. It just undermined the proceedings immediately thereafter. But both films, however, were really an exercise in cynical, bad faith fan service maneuvers, and the latest installment was just exposition fest. It possibly is a hedge against audience members maybe unfamiliar with the 1978 original, and at this point you'd have to ask, who cares? If they don't know it, don't make it so they have to know it. You can introduce a new story so that even if you haven't seen the original Halloween in 20 years or whatever it is, you can be on board with narrative, proper storytelling. That means a few characters in whom you can properly invest with character arcs that go somewhere, that lead somewhere, that accomplish something. Nothing really happens to that end. In Halloween Kills, to keep the old guard placated, I guess, Blumhouse really shoehorned in a bunch of the original faces from 1978. But really, like, as someone who's seen the 1978 film at least three or four times, I don't have any particular vested interest in what the hell the nurse who got grabbed around the throat has to say or do with anything in the local proceedings, or why she would get together with a bunch of like-minded or similarly situated locals in a bar as opposed to maybe a church basement to get trauma counseling or something, and on Halloween as well. Like, why are all these people still in Haddonfield? This is a small suburb. Why are these people so fixated on something that happened decades ago? I mean, it would take years, obviously, to overcome that and PTSD and whatnot. But having these people brought, like, how do they meet one another? What is it? Some sort of support group online, victims of Michael Myers, .com. It's just the whole setup and Tommy Doyle giving this open mic talent night discussion and exposition fest about what happened back in the day is just really dumb, really pointless. And he's basically, as a character, hijacking people's good time on Halloween to give this campfire tale, and people are really supposed to be enjoying themselves on Halloween, whooping it up, getting all in costume and hitting the dance floor, and having some guy sound off with this spoken word bollocks, a bunch of bullshit, is just hackneyed, incredibly shoehorned in crapola. What you get also in Halloween Kills is a bunch of strung together vignette set pieces showcasing just a bunch of ways people become worm food. It just a bunch of different disparate people, absent telling an actual cohesive story. That's not totally correct, because the characters actually tell a story, but what they're doing is telling a story by rehashing events from 40 years ago. Or worse, talking about what's happening now. Like, everyone knows the mythology of it, and it's not like it's some overly complicated thing. A guy in a mask killed people. You don't need to have this giant exposition to detail who did what to whom and why and all this. It's just totally irrelevant. And when the spotlight shined on the three surviving victims of Michael Myers' attacks, and it was just like, okay, it's like clanging two pots together to get someone's attention. Okay, we get it. They're the victims. And okay, shine the spotlight on them. Just unbelievable. You don't need to do it literally or metaphorically, because they're useless people to have around in this number. You could have maybe one to be a companion to Laurie Strode, so they can maybe team up from the dramatic standpoint to maybe strengthen numbers, get them together. You could have one surviving cop, and you could maybe build something around that. But then you just have just endless characters just there for no apparent purpose, no apparent function. Nothing really is made of anything. They could have done quite a bit more by doing something, let's say. If you're going to retcon all the interceding Halloweens, they could have done something that 2018 failed to do, which was give us a real interesting and intriguing Loomis, one that built on the legacy built up by the iconic Donald Pleasance. And something that would have spoken in his voice, and something that could have continued the legacy on while speaking to a new audience. And now the new Loomis, as he was called in 2018, was just pointlessly introduced and subsequently dispatched. Just for no reason does he, I guess it's some sort of Stockholm syndrome from tending to Michael, and somehow he goes nuts as well. There's no reason to think anyone would. Why this was another one of the dumbest plot points, and in the theater there's audible groans when this happened. Donald Pleasance as Loomis was our resident expert back in the day, right? So it makes sense to replace him. So what you could do is have a new crop of Haddonfield psychologists, clinicians, psychiatrists, and what they could do is be at loggerheads or be at odds with Loomis's research, and you could see, they could have them potentially disparage the old doc's research and pronouncements about Michael being pure evil, saying that there's no such thing as pure evil because that's unscientific. And so the new Loomis you could have doing original clinical research himself, and put him maybe against his colleagues as a standout. And his colleagues might be biological determinists who believe that pharmaceutical interventions are the way of the future, and who dispense with all the other more fuzzy aspects of psychology and psychiatry. It almost could be how the psychotherapy community treats the research of Sigmund Freud, which obviously has immense value, but is frequently and unfairly dispensed with by people who fancy themselves biological reductionists and science-minded people who don't appreciate the wealth of wisdom that Sigmund Freud was able to bring to a whole litany of human experience. So I think that's something that could potentially have been interesting with a new Loomis. It could have provided nice tension, therapeutical tension, if you will, because you could have unheeded calls from an expert whose expertise is being questioned by colleagues who think his methodologies are maybe out of step with reality, and maybe tell the police to ignore it. I was thinking also that, because Jeff and I took part in this, that when we were on vacation in London, we actually did a Jack the Ripper tour in Whitechapel. And you can listen to our podcasts about Hands of the Ripper and whatnot, which we recorded from a hotel room in London near Notting Hill, where we're staying. But you know, whether it's like Jeffrey Dahmer in Milwaukee, or like there's a real cottage industry of Jack the Ripper tours in London, and you could see tours being led around, competing tours, and often you'll have 8 to 10 different tours going on at any one time, perhaps even more. That's just the ones we saw that we knew of. These kinds of excursions could have provided a more natural way to provide exposition in a way that someone's standing there in a bar doing a spoken word send-off. Not just that, as Jeff and I found out, these true crime tours are populated by true crime pedants and amateur sleuths, the type of people who typically go to Reddit and argue their case. And there's a lot of intelligent, obsessed people. And what better way to bring the Michael Myers mystique or mythos to life would be a true crime tour of Haddonfield that's maybe led out of Chicago nearby. And you could have various theories as to what happened in the interceding decades to Michael. Like, what happened to him? Maybe he had experimental treatments done at Haddonfield Memorial. Maybe he changed his identity and is living in Arizona, being a groundskeeper at a golf course. Maybe went to prison and that's why the murders stopped. This was something that people at the time thought had happened to BTK. BTK killer, bind, torture, kill. He took a long hiatus from killing and then resumed. And I think it's just family obligations took hold. That was a strange case, but did Michael Myers flee the country? Even and better still, in keeping with the original mystique, does he even exist at all? That could be something that could be a question, given that he's, you know, his nickname the Shape, and he has a very underpinnings of supernatural to him that I think Rob Zombie did a disservice to by giving him this lengthy backstory and having him grow up in a conventional abusive household. And I think it takes away from the supernatural elements that made the first Halloween so mercurial and so strange and so ethereal in a way. Yeah, again, Myers works best when he's lurking in the shadows, and you could have people on these tours, after the tours are done, you could have them disband and maybe investigate independently, and then you could have them be picked off one by one, so Myers can continue to do what he does best, which is lurk in the shadows and pick people off one by one. It's almost like an opportunistic hunter in the Serengeti or something. It's not about a lion chasing a herd of gazelles. It's about sitting, lying in wait like a crocodile, waiting for the hippos to come and drink by the by the water. I might be beating that metaphor to death here, but I think there's potential for creating dramatic tension as well if you have a true crime tour between Chicago detectives who are investigating locals going missing in Haddonfield, and also maybe the tension that inevitably crops up when you have townie detectives who are dismissed out of hand, typically by big city cops for not knowing what the hell they're doing, and you could create an overlapping jurisdiction issue to wonder what is going on and who should be investigating what, and you could have problems with that kind of tension being brought up. And I think it's not exactly the most original thing, but it's something that could have added to the narrative to at least provide some kind of tension. Myers' story, I mean, with Jack the Ripper, you had pundits linking the Whitechapel murderer to the royal family, and basically generated a wealth of plausible and many times implausible scenarios as to who that killer was. So in some of it just purely conjectural, and others based on extant and pre-existing Scotland Yard documents in that. So when you reboot Halloween, what might have been interesting is to actually have FBI profilers posit a bunch of different scenarios about who this person could be, and have the profiles come up wanting, because again, this keeps to John Carpenter's original filmic vision of Myers being a supernatural force rather than some run-of-the-mill spree killer or some sort of Jason Voorhees copycat, which is not what I come to Halloween for. I want atmosphere, I want lurking in the shadows. The original film was not overly violent. I don't need brutal kills. I'm not some 18-year-old looking to boast their horror bona fides by being able to endure a bunch of things. There are other movies like Hostel or maybe Hellraiser that are really dependent on gore and disgustingness and bloodletting and the entire body of work of Lucio Fulci's horror space. But this is not one of those films. You don't need that. The one thing I think that Halloween 2018 got right is the Laurie Strode's, I think, decline thanks to the events of 1978. But I think that has also become a cliche when you have stuff like Star Wars retconning Luke Skywalker by turning him into this shaken, hollow shell of a man after being an iconic hero for movies on end. And so it is a little bit of a cliche, but at least this is something that is more plausible than a great Jedi warrior falling apart at the seams decades hence. That someone like Laurie, who was a victim of this killer, would be someone who maybe wouldn't be able to move on with her life as flippantly and easily as someone else in different circumstances. So I think a nicer way to tie things together and square the circle would have her reconnect with the new Loomis after being met with function as an unreliable narrator, much as she did in Halloween H2O, where she could be thinking that Michael's around the corner at any turn, but being told by the psychiatrist that's impossible, that they've developed some fail-safe way to keep him locked up, or that he's been given meds, or that he's been paroled and he's on the other side of the country, or some such thing. Like you can find some way to have her and someone else, again one of the survivors, not multiple, but form a united front against these experts, but also putting up a united front against Michael Myers and go after him in a proper way. And you could have her question her sanity and whether her account of the shape is even trustworthy at all, given again the supernatural undertones. I think that adds for some dramatic tension. Now, speaking of dramatic tension, what you could have done with Tommy Doyle is, instead of making him a de facto mayor of this town and a community organizer and galvanizing the public against Myers, evil dies tonight and all that silly, just WWF style histrionic. It was almost like people, like the Titanic smashing the iceberg, the way everyone was carrying on about that. But it would have been interesting to make Tommy Doyle a conspiratorial wingnut. And you could have him believe that Michael Myers is the lab creation of some sordid government experiment. And you could have him be at odds with Laurie Strode, and then that would be a further way to divide residents of Haddonfield, like who are maybe not following the case or the ones who are, saying, who would you be, Team Laurie or Team Tommy? Whose account of that night in question is more believable? And you could say, well, you know, Tommy was just a young kid, but maybe he saw something. But how can you he was just a kid. How can you really take what he said at face value? And then you could have him be one of these basement neckbeard cranks, maybe going on Reddit and offering his theories, and maybe being some egg-headed grad student and dispensing his thoughts on the case years hence. You could have him be the podcast guest and have him being at odds with Laurie Strode. There are many ways to do it. Officer Hawkins, another one. The original responding officer from the first Halloween, he could be living his life in retirement, and he could be another one who has PTSD, or he just got out of the policing business and is enticed to investigate the case as a de facto expert, which is frequently the case. You could have him be some sort of Seven type, long in the tooth, but full of weary wisdom type character to inject himself into this story. And in 2018, I mean, they basically just have him get stabbed in the neck and then get run over, and then just to deliver a line of exposition when he comes to, instead of saying, tell my wife I love her or get me a doctor, he just says, you know, we have to get Myers. It's just, he's a useless, pointless character. But you could have him gently eased out of retirement, or you could have had him be a conspiracy nut, or you could have him being just saying, look, I think anyone who thinks he's still alive is a lunatic, and I don't know why you're bothering with these, conjuring up this mythology surrounding this killer who I clearly shot and killed, or I never mind, it doesn't even matter. What you could leave him out altogether. The Halloween house, the structure could be slated for redevelopment as part of a condo project. You could have a real estate agent showing it, who could be killed as well after it being that they could provide unreliable narrator dialogue as well. You could have real estate agents saying, like, this is where something happened years ago, but obviously nothing has happened since. Lovely families have been in there. There's nothing, no such thing as a curse. There's no such thing as bad mojo. This is something that happened way, way in the past. It's not like every house where a murder has occurred is razed and turned to dust like the Manson family home. Which was, I think, owned briefly by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, but it's just it's not every. I think the one in Cleveland where the killer was keeping prostitutes in the basement, that might have been raised as well. But it's this was again a small local. In the grand scheme of things, not particularly important spate of killings that occurred on Halloween. It's actually one of the characters mentions in Halloween 2018, that why are people so obsessed with this? Because in the great pantheon of horror and horrific acts that have been committed and atrocities, you have, even just in Toronto, you have a serial killer who preyed on the gay community here. You know, particularly newcomers who couldn't be out to their families. And you have spree shooters, and you have the DC snipers, and you have just the Green River Killer, just endless crop of lunatics. So it's true. They did mention that in 2018. Why all the fuss and hubbub about this? Well, there's a lot of mythology you can make up, and you can keep the mystique of Michael Myers by keeping him supernatural, and then just let sleeping dogs lie. If you have to reboot this, just keep him an enigma, keep him a mystery, keep you maybe leave the door open for subsequent sequels, but don't give him a backstory. The way he cocks his head and acts so enigmatic and bizarre is one of the hallmarks of the film and what makes this such a standout amongst many, many, many others and many imitators. There's only so many imitators. There's never a duplicator. 1978's Halloween is, without nonpareil, one of the greatest horror films of all time. You can't mess with success. Don't even try, I would think. But if you have to, maybe some of these suggestions, if anyone's listening, maybe take these on. Take it in a different direction. Don't have to explain everything. Don't need a whiteboard. You don't need a flow chart. You don't need to know what happened on the night in question in 1978. Let's just take things into different territories. Let's move. Like Ezra Pound said, make it new. The injunction for modernists everywhere when the modernist movement was coming to a fore in the turn of last century. Make new art. Make something new. Stop rehashing old ideas. Stop going back to the well for this stuff. Anyway, check out our books, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. We have lots of very creative kills in that one, far more creative than any of the recent Halloween films. And of course, Mine's Bigger Than Yours, our homage to 80s action, those really great, iconic action movies from the 80s and 90s. And we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.